Hi, welcome everybody to a very special Agenda Awani session, because Agenda Awani is a good friend of the World Economic Forum, and I myself was invited to moderate an official session on value chain, making it more resilient, looking at the innovation, partnership, collaboration and stuff for the recently concluded Davos Agenda Week. Scores of world leaders, more than 1,400 key movers and shakers from the public sector, private sector, everybody was online for the first time, because this year in January, I'm sorry, there's no Davos, there's only Davos Agenda Week, but World Economic Forum will happen in May, just down south from Malaysia. So today, as the media affiliate session, I'm proud to have three local experts and thought leaders, plus one representative from the World Economic Forum. I would like to welcome, good morning, our guest first, as is the tradition of Malaysia. We welcome our guest, Ian Cronin. Ian is in Geneva. It's very cool right there. People are skiing and everything else, but he has to set Sunday to be with us. Ian is the project lead, and his team looks at the future of advanced manufacturing and production system initiative at the World Economic Forum. So if you want to know about trade tech and everything else, Ian is the guy to go. And then, of course, Sifu for the nation for the longest time, Dr. Jomo Kongwen Sundaram, thank you so much for making time. I know you're very, very busy. Foreign media utilize and hog you more than local media, but I just want to add the quota of local media up, because otherwise Prof. Jomo will be talking to the Americans, the Europeans, and everyone else. And then, powerful ladies, of course, must have in any panel discussion, especially nowadays. Lady in Red, the tech lady that came back all the way from Wall Street to be with us and to help Malaysia make digital economy a reality. Surina Shukri, the CEO of, you know, what else but MDEC, our digital economy corporation that has reinvented itself recently and announced it to the world, and they are confident they can carry us through. But this is the pandemic era, so we need powerful, intelligent thought leaders and movers and shakers also in the health sector. So I have Saudari Wan Nadia, Wan Muhammad Abdullah Yaakob, and she's of course the group CEO of TMC Life Sciences Berhad. So I'm just going to go straight to it. The topic that we have set out is very simple. It's called the Great Reset, and World Economic Forum Professor Shaw have been championing this. But if it's a Great Reset, how do we kickstart fourth industrial revolution within this pandemic era with all the challenges? Because the issues and the challenges we had before the pandemic itself was already great. They were already a lot. Dr. Jomo has been with me on Agenda Awani before talking about that. And I myself have made the point that even before this pandemic, my industry, the media and communication industry, was already suffering. And suddenly, because of Capitol Hill insurgency, if I can put it like that, Twitter suddenly take editorial decisions. Facebook take editorial decisions. Before this, they said, no, we're just a market and a platform. We don't deal with content and the politics of content, economics of content. So things are changing. This is the new normal. So I'm going to start in this side of the world, Ian. We let our guest speak first. So I'm going to let you have the first salvo. If that's one thing that must be done now, what would you want it to be?
It's a lot of pressure to go first with this esteemed panel, so thank you. You know, as you mentioned, the issues are great right now, and I think what we've seen is there were issues before, but that just means that the solutions that people were beginning to talk about before are even more important right now. And so when I think about what needs to happen now, people were talking about the large corporations that sit and engage in key industry areas like Malaysia need to engage better with the base manufacturers in those regions. We need to have better collaboration sharing across these value chains. Okay. And I think companies are starting to realize that now. It became very evident in the last year, and I think it'll just continue to accelerate now.
Yeah, before I go to the other panelists, Ian, I just want to pick your brain on that.
Yeah.
It seems to be sort of very ad hoc. It seems to be on whether that particular company or that particular group wants to do it, but we can't afford that, right? We need a more harmonized, systematic, and all across the board kind of transition.
Yeah, I think you're right. You need something all across the board, but you also have to choose places to start. And I mean, we have my esteemed colleague from the MDEC here, and I think digital is a perfect place. When we start thinking about companies are already capturing so much data at every level and at every place along the value chain in large companies and small companies. Okay. And that's actually based by sharing data okay. and collaborating across data. We can find innovation and efficiency opportunities and actually right. help accelerate the growth in all economies.
Okay, Dr. Jomo, I know you have your own views of the fourth industrial revolution, of the definition of it, the approach of it, of the Great Reset. So over to you.
Thank you very much, Kamarul. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. Let me emphasize that I really don't agree with the idea of the fourth industrial revolution, only because it implies that there's something tremendously different about the current changes which we are experiencing. However, as far as the Great Reset is concerned, it is undoubtedly true that the COVID-19 pandemic and the various governmental responses, successful as well as failed responses, and other responses have basically forced us to redo many things. So I do think that there is some resetting. The extent of that reset will very much depend, as you correctly identify, on a great number of factors, not only in terms of what governments do, but also about how enterprises, including, let us not forget, the smallest ones, respond to this whole situation. Okay. And the correct incentives need to be put in place in order to motivate people to do the right thing. This is not something which is automatic. Yes. And I'm afraid that those incentives have not been put in place, and there's very little sign that those incentives are being put in place. Governments have a huge opportunity because the recovery will depend very, very heavily on government leadership, particularly now we have an unusual consensus that, you know, the Bretton Woods institutions, for example, are urging governments to spend more and think about paying back later, not to be obsessed with debt levels and credit ratings and so on and so forth. But having said that, we do not have the kind of determination of, say, Roosevelt. When Roosevelt was leading the United States after the onset of the Great Depression, he came up with this New Deal and a series of other innovations after the New Deal itself, which were very, very important in changing the very nature of the world, of the American economy and its relationship to the rest of the world. Unfortunately, okay. There is very little evidence of that type of leadership at the political level. Obviously, companies are trying to make a lot of money. We know how billionaires have been very successful in increasing their wealth in the recent year. But having said all that, it's not very clear that what the nature of that reset is going to be. Undoubtedly, because of the disruptions we have seen, companies have to do things very differently. Companies have been asked by the previous U.S. administration as well as the previous Japanese administration to withdraw, for example, from China. Those of us who are integrated with China also find that our economies are being affected by this. But we don't see the great change which is taking place since the Biden administration came in, and we still don't see any other changes as far as Europe is concerned. The tiffs, for example, between the European Commission president and the EU with some of the private companies do not promise a great deal of change as far as, for example, our preparedness for major disruptions of this type. So I think without taking up too much time, I think it is important to say that, yes, I think we have an opportunity to reset, but I'm not so sure that resetting is taking place. And I do think that it is important for us to recognize the kinds of changes which have been going on in the world. And it's very good that we have our two women leaders here who are very well qualified to provide, to think about the kind of preparedness which we should have going forward. Thank you.
Serena, digital is no longer a luxury. It is a necessity.
Yes.
But we know the problems are plenty. Give us some silver lining here. What can we do now?
So I would start, you know, we talked just now about macro, but when we talk about change, when we talk about reset, and you said, what can we do now? I think one of the most important things is to embrace this new mindset of change. I always say, for things to change, I must change first. And today we live in a digital by default way, and we can see all around, people are no longer asking, why do we need to go digital? It's how do we go digital? And the silver lining in all of this, particularly for me, is starting to see everybody embrace this new sense of change. How do I do things differently? How do I leverage technology? How do I go online? We're already starting to see that. But I think when it comes to the topic of reset and the topics that just now Professor alluded to, I think the most important thing that we need to embrace right now, to do right now, is sense of urgency. Because like right now, everybody, leaders especially, we need to embrace that change is required. This reset is required. The status quo doesn't work. And so how do we go about that? It begins with a mindset of change.
Surina, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 not wanting to change, 10 very willingly wanting to change, where are we right now on average?
You're talking about Malaysia?
Yes, leadership.
I would say 6-7 in general.
Yes, Doc, you raise your hand. Dr. Jomo, before I go to Wan?
Well, no. I think let's...
Okay. Let's go to Wan Nadia. Wan, you're in the private sector of public or private health, you know? And nowadays, when we look at new cases in Malaysia, over 4,000, you know, 5,000, those kind of numbers, now there's a debate in social media. How do you look at the numbers? And now, suddenly, there's a backlog of cases. And then when you look at stuff, we have the tallest twin towers of the world, and we have a backlog of cases and data of cases, and we have the multimedia super corridor like 30 years ago, for example. So please put it in context regarding epidemiology and public health for us, Wan.
So I think from the health perspective, going back to where you started about media, I think communication is actually really important because there are a lot of difficult decisions that need to be made. And if the communication is not done properly, it's very difficult to then have any effective change in the community, which is essentially where the change needs to happen in order to have an impact. So if we look at countries like Malaysia, we have had to confront difficult perceptions and our attitudes towards issues that have long fallen through the cracks or papered over. Things like prisons and the condition of prisons, foreign workers, how we treat foreign workers, how we house them. And all these issues are now coming to a boil at a very rapid rate. And I think that... This is part of the transition that we need to go through, a social change, because people then realize that health is something that's not by citizenship. Okay. It should not be by vaccination. It should also include people who are not citizens. Yeah. And I think that, you know, if we look at the contrast between the U.S., perhaps in other countries like New Zealand, the communication from the top to the bottom has been very important to differentiate the effectiveness of how the response has been to the pandemic.
Okay. Ian, I want to go back to you, but after this is a free-for-all, you don't have to wait for queue. This is a very Starbucks group chat session. Ian, in the Davos Agenda Week forums, and I've looked at the President Cyril Ramaphosa, I've looked at what Prime Minister Hsien Loong said, I look at many leaders, even I look at the CEO and chair of Pfizer, they all talk about collaboration and partnership and multilateral. But the fact is, Ian, if you look at the statistic, and we're going to put the graph when it goes on TV, they are a developed nation who has ordered the vaccine like 5 times more than their population. You know, if their population, let's say for sake of easy to remember number, let's say it's 5 people, they ordered like 25 doses of vaccine, and in the map that will be shown, Africa is not even 1% having the order of vaccine. Asia is a bit more, but not that many also. And the way vaccine and pandemic can be fighting is that everyone must be healthy so that there's no more bodies for the virus to infect. For example. So even from the supply of the cure or the protection against the pandemic, the supply chain and the value chain is already lopsided, Ian. How is the World Economic Forum looking at this issue?
Yeah, it's a fantastic point and question. And I think one of the things that we're looking at is if you are really trying to move towards a great reset, equity has to be a huge part of that conversation moving forward. And I think that this goes into, it's important in the vaccine conversation, but it's also important when we think about the distribution resources around the world and how we work and collaborate with our partners. And to be honest, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there in different sectors and different industries and how countries collaborate and actually do work together and not just pay lip service to these ideas. But I do think you mentioned it was really important that collaboration was mentioned by all these senior leaders during the Davos agenda. Yeah. And that's where we have to start. I think it has to, they're very clearly putting it on their agenda with their words. If we've learned anything in recent times, words are powerful. And I think the fact we're seeing this on the minds of key leaders around the world is really important. Now we have to actually say, what does that mean when we translate that into reality? And it's going to be a little bit of a balance. Obviously, some things can't be balanced, but when we think about the idea of equitable engagement in the economy, I think this is a space where the companies need to be working with governments to make sure that this is a back and forth and communicatory process where this is something that unfolds over time.
Saudari Wan, can you weave in into this? Because let me wrap my head around it. The vaccine, there's only, we are struggling to produce it, and time is of the utmost importance. Those who have more will buy at the higher prices and get first right of refusal. In Southeast Asia, only Singapore could do and play that game well. And New Zealand bought for the whole of the other countries like the Pacific Islanders because they know if they only vaccinate their own population, the cultural and the intermingling will, you know, defeat the purpose anyway. So how do you look at this? Because you're looking at this from the private sector health provider. There will be clamor from the free market that if I have the resources, I want to get my team or my company or my family vaccinated first. I don't want to wait for the government, for example. But on the other hand, if we play that game, the inequality will come back and kill us because from the epidemiology perspective, it doesn't make sense for you to be vaccinated with your group of people because any other people can reinfect you. So how do you look at this?
So I think what's interesting with the vaccination now is that primarily the procurement has been a government-to-government initiative, and a lot of people have been clamoring where there would be vaccines that will happen. But because the demand far exceeds the supply of the vaccines at the present moment, it is only the governments that are clamoring amongst themselves and then determining within their country how those vaccines will be distributed. And having said that, I think with vaccinations, we are seeing a lot more candidates come on board, and a lot of people are obsessing over the efficacy of the vaccine, comparing perhaps Pfizer and Moderna's 90-95% efficacy with perhaps Johnson & Johnson's 59-65% efficacy. But I think the fact of the matter is that any vaccine that prevents severe COVID is worth taking. And I think that as we have more and more vaccine candidates, I think then the supply chain will become a little bit better. And I think that we have seen a very interesting reset, so to speak, where the US government significantly funded the development of the Moderna vaccine, thereby securing for themselves that supply and also enabling Moderna to then sell those vaccines at a much more subsidized rate. So perhaps in the future, the way aid is distributed or financial subsidies are distributed will be working through companies like this who are developing goods that now the pandemic has shown is really a public good. Because I think previously perhaps the perception was that, I developed this product, I have the patent for it, and therefore it's sort of like a private good. But I think that this is not the last pandemic that we will see coming to hit the world. And therefore, I think this change in mindset is really important.
So do you think we should play the vaccine nationalism game and, build up our own R&D and have our own capabilities to produce vaccine for the future?
Definitely, I think where we saw where we were last year in March with the PPE supply crunch, definitely, I think there was a lot of nationalism that came into play. And we now see the EU looking at export bans for the AstraZeneca vaccine. I think things that are related to the healthcare supply chain have now become matters of national security concern. So you notice that Singapore has then developed the ability to produce 3-ply masks, because previously they only did N95 and they imported the 3-ply from Malaysia. But then they realized they don't want to have that reliance on any other foreign country for key supplies that would affect the safety of their country. So I think this is definitely something that would change perhaps the geopolitical situation and how countries will later negotiate their way around things. And I think that any country would want to look at the security and sustainability of the supply of these products.
Dr. Jomo, everyone, Nadia said, you know, geopolitics and stuff, but I want to go to the political economic side. And if everyone does what Singapore does what EU wants to do, like I want my own tribe to get it first, then how are we going to have this multilateral collaboration and partnership which are needed to actually scientifically solve the pandemic?
Well, unfortunately, science does not speak with a single voice. Okay. But I think that the points both of you have been making, Nadia's point is very basic, that it's not as if we didn't have those capacities. Many of those capacities actually existed. Malaysia has experienced quite a number of viral infections, and we've actually led the world in some areas. For example, vis-a-vis Nipah. The Nipah virus, Malaysia developed the necessary medicines as well as vaccines in response to that. And the Kerala minister, for example, has been very grateful, publicly expressing her appreciation for what Malaysia did in terms of helping. So it's not as if Malaysia doesn't have those capacities, but those capacities have unfortunately been run down over the last few decades as we have increasingly favored the private sector. And what the private sector, unfortunately, in Malaysia, for much of this, involves transnational companies. So the Malaysian companies which are involved are often little more than, you know, import agents. Okay, this is very unfortunate. Malaysia did have capacities. Some of you might probably not old enough to remember, but Kamarul, you might remember that there was a in Section 13 in Petaling Jaya capacity to make medicines.
Right.
But we cannot possibly start doing everything in anticipation of the next virus, because we have no idea what are the characteristics of the next virus are, and so on and so forth. If we had a situation in the world where you had cooperation, and that cooperation was truly cooperative on the basis of need rather than on the basis of who has the money, we would be talking about a very different situation. But unfortunately, that is not the case. Besides vaccine nationalism, there is also the question of money talks. Why is it that some people have been able to get access and other people have not been able to get access? So these two factors of seeking national advantage on the one hand, vaccine nationalism, as well as the whole question of who has money and who can afford it, has basically frustrated the possibility. Now, as Nadia mentioned, the development, maybe it was Surina who mentioned it, the development of the vaccines was made possible partly through Operation Warp Speed. Whatever one might say about President Trump, you know, he really ramped up that whole effort. Now you have that knowledge. You've basically paid for it. But because of the unwillingness of all the major companies to share the necessary knowledge, share the necessary information, okay, we do not have the ability for others, generic producers, to do it. Now Ian knows very well that we have, for example, the Serum Institute of India has this capacity to make vaccines on a mass scale in very, very quick time. They are probably the only ones with established, recognized capacity, but I'm told that China is trying to develop similar capacities and so on and so forth. So you have that possibility, but you cannot do that unless you share that information. When China realized that it was up against a completely new virus, which was very infectious and also lethal, China shared its information. As early as the second week of January. But since then, how much have we progressed in terms of sharing information, making available information, and so on and so forth? So this problem right now, which the two of you have been talking about, is a problem of our own making, because we have a dysfunctional system. And this is part of the reason why I'm not very optimistic about the Great Reset, because we have all these vested interests, whether moneyed interests or political
national interest,
standing in the way of better cooperation in our common good, for the common.
I want to go to how technology can help with that. But before that, Ian, if you can weave in, even in the session that I moderated, audits from Bain and Company, Lansing, Koch Holdings, they all talk about sharing. The system globally needs to be more transparent. Mm. But the reality is, when it involves profit and revenue, companies won't automatically be looking at sharing and making things transparent. So it would have to reside maybe more on a public-private partnership globally, something like what Bretton Woods did for those purposes before, but this time, because we know that the era of pandemic and more viruses might be coming, can't we have that? Can't a global alliance like Gavi, for example, be empowered together with the UN agencies like, WHO or whatever else, to at least make a platform? And of course, there are problems, there are vested interests, but at least those who want to change can be empowered to change first. Isn't this the approach of stakeholder capitalism of WF?
Well, I think, first and foremost, I'm not a vaccine distribution expert, but I can tell you that when we're talking about what the private companies are thinking about in this region, the question around, do we produce here or do we rely on sort of the global value chains? Private companies, which can be an indication of sort of where this is headed, from a thought standpoint more globally, are looking at the old model of just, cost competitiveness, let me find the cheapest place to produce, shifting to a little bit more of a risk model where I need to balance that. I need to be doing more locally and still having part of my supply chains reliant on this global perspective. And so I think, in any industry, whether you're talking about vaccine distributions, countries are going to be thinking similarly. I need to have some of this capacity here, without totally giving up on my reliance of this global system. Now, that second piece is really getting into what you're talking about. If we are going for the elements that we're still reliant on the global ecosystem and that we need collaboration and partners, what's the actual functionality of those relationships, and how do we make sure that it doesn't shift entirely to this return to I'm going to produce everything and not share anything? And that's the balance. And I think there are institutions like Gavi, like the World Health Organization, that are trying to create platforms to facilitate access. But that also means that global leaders need to also support those efforts. And I think what we heard last week was that these leaders are saying collaboration and working together is still critical to the functioning of the global economy. And now it needs to we'll see what happens in the coming future to see how we can actually deliver on that.
Serena, can you clean that up for us a bit from how can technology weave in into all this and help make it better?
Yeah, so I want to touch on one thing that Prof said and also Ian said before. I think coming back to the original topic of reset, I think one of the most important things that we all embrace right now is that this reset needs to be human-centric. We really, really, really need to prioritize people. And so when it comes to decisions around vaccines, government-to-government conversations and private sector, it really has to prioritize people first. This means it's inclusion. It means figuring out all these aspects that's required. And when it comes to dealing with people, and everybody has an opinion on certain things, how do you get people? How do you get to decisions? That's where data comes in. By using data objectively, to drive discussions, I think that will actually help collaboration happen much more quicker, because you let facts speak for itself, not opinions.
How do we, what you said just now, the political will for everybody to sit together, in the case, because we know the backlog is because we haven't moved to digital wholeheartedly. We are still hoping and taking painful steps on the manual and analog in contact tracing. Now that we have that problem, how do we solve that fast?
I think this is where there really needs to be collaboration between private and public sector in the sense of bringing in expertise. I think that in the context, in the country in general, topics like data, topics like technology, unfortunately, a lot of the expertise relies in the private sector. And so I think really bringing in more technocrats into government, for example, that's one way that we could actually execute much faster. Get the experts, leverage, sit down, brainstorm together, and really have this eye towards execution. I think that's one way to go about it.
In the four windows that I'm seeing, the one below you is from the private sector. Saudari Wan, tolong.
I think one of the major issues that we will have to confront is this issue of trust, because we're talking about personal data, and when we talk about health data, even more so. And so there will be pushback from people if there are no trust in the institutions, because people don't know what you're using that information for. Now, I had a conversation with the Vietnamese health minister. For them, as a communist country, it was very easy for them to push through change, because they just, she told me, we just issue a circular and everybody follows. Well, that doesn't happen in countries like Malaysia or the US, where you have to constantly engage with stakeholders, and underlying that engagement has to be trust. And I think that that coming out of that is something that we really need to, when it comes to data, and you are asking private citizens to disclose amazing amounts of data for themselves, and all these controversies around Facebook recently, WhatsApp, and all those things. I think clear leadership is required to send a clear communication. Why do we need this data? How is it going to be used? And if something were to go wrong, that we would do the right thing and side with the people rather than vested interests.
I'm afraid I have to come in and disagree with my dear friend Nadia on this. I don't think it's a question of having a communist party. I mean, you have that in China, you have that in Vietnam, you have that in Kerala, arguably you have that in Laos. But you look at Japan, look at Taiwan. You know, they've all done well, you know, and Korea, they've done well. They don't have a communist party running those countries. You know, but what they do have are legitimate governments, governments which rely on people who trust the people. And so Nadia's point about trust is absolutely important. But what do we have here? We do not have information which is easily readily available on how the virus has spread. We get announcements every day at a particular level, at the national level usually. And that does not help, is not conducive to serious analysis. Surina knows very well how in other countries data has been used so effectively to do contact tracing, data has been used so effectively to identify and isolate the communities which are most threatened and so on and so forth. And so I think we have a question of trust, but it's not a question of whether or not you have a communist party, I have to say.
No, I say in the absence of trust, then understood, you need a communist party.
can I just jump in? Because I think that's the point there is really interesting, and I'm sure Serena could even speak to this more extensively, but trust can also be facilitated by some of these technologies that we're talking about, and excuse me, Professor, but to use the term fourth industrial revolution, because the underlying data, it can apply when we're talking about the health sector, but it's also critical when we're talking about manufacturing and the ability to create trust and leverage technology to create also a guiding framework for how we exchange that data so people do feel more secure. Whether health is a great example of where we want to share some things, but not everything. But even companies, when they're worried about their IP and sharing with other players across their supply chains and ecosystems, We can use new technologies to make sure that we're sharing perhaps sustainability data, because that's something we all perhaps would benefit from sharing, but not sharing things critical to our IP. So I think there's a lot here that technology can unlock to help with the things that data can provide.
Yeah, as long as you're on that track, Ian, sorry to interject, but can you give an example? I know there's a lot of discussion regarding trade tech now, trade technology, to go to where you are saying, so that, you know, multiple players, multiple nation, multiple companies, public, private sector buyers, how is the advancement in trade tech, for example, helping this value chain getting to be to the trust that you have alluded to?
Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the so again, I'm not, trade technology is not my area of expertise, but I can tell you that one of the things we've seen, we have an initiative on data sharing for innovation, and actually where companies have created their own frameworks to support one another in the sharing of critical data elements to perhaps create greater sustainability across that supply chain. And inevitably, you begin talking about trade. And there's conversations all around the world about carbon taxes and how that's going to impact our trade systems in the future. Or what are the elements of digital trade that are going into it? Right now, there's generally from the WTO, no taxes on the transmission of digital files. So I think when we begin to talk about what are the elements of the technologies that can support the exchange of data information, these are going to be critical foundations and bedrocks. And it's important, you know, going back to the very beginning, the sense of urgency that I think Serena mentioned, like that's important for governments and economies to be thinking about and companies to be thinking about now, because these transitions and changes are going to happen. And you can either be a part of shaping those changes, or you can react to changes that other people have shaped.
Okay. We're going towards the last stretch. Okay, Serena, I'll allow you that comment first.
Yeah, I was gonna add. So your question around how does technology help? Because at the end of the day, when you think about technology, it really it helps with. There are so many collaboration tools out there, and this whole trade tech, for example, are just different frameworks, different ways that technology enables collaboration, real time collaboration, that increase the speed. I also want to come back to the topic of trust just now. So, of course, trust is really, really important in everything that we do. Even handling data requires trust. But in order for us to have trust, and this is key, you must seek to understand. I think the big problem that we're having in the world right now is that nobody is seeking to understand. No one's trying. I mean, we're not learning fast enough. And so in order for us to create trust in new technology, we need to understand what it is. In order for us to create trust in between private sector, you have to engage, you have to try and understand each other. In order for us as a consumer to create trust in new ways of doing things, you have to understand. So I think like this spirit of learning, this intensity in terms of trying to understand something new, embracing the sense of change, it all starts with this curiosity. I think that's really important for us to, it's part of the whole reset that's required.
So Dari Wan, Nadia, I like that point. So I'm going to leverage that to you, because you deal at the forefront and your clients are not the clients that, you know, the average that goes to Hospital Kuala Lumpur, for example. How do you even start on that? Because if Serena is talking about understanding, it comes from literacy, it comes from awareness. Yeah. Even to wash hands, the director general has to repeat that every day, and people are still trying to differentiate in certain areas what's COVID-19 and what's SARS-CoV-2, you know. And then on the other hand, you have tech like blockchain that could really safeguard your data, because no single one point person can have every 100% of your data. Everybody have just bits and pieces, but people are even struggling to understand what they must know about the pandemic, about a certain basic understanding of epidemiology. So when it comes to what Serena has mentioned just now, I just want your perspective, because you're from the private side. How do you look at the level of awareness, and how is that critical to this fight, not only against COVID, but everything else? Because if we were to get trust, there must be a party and a force that spreads the literacy and the awareness first.
And when you talk about, you know, communication and fake news and awareness and who is right and who is wrong, I think that, you know, going back to that conversation that we have, that platforms matter, the type of communication matters. And I mean, education is also going to be a key issue. I think, you know, in the past, we have people who don't understand simple basis of biology and technology, and you're trying to then load, and they're getting this information about RNA vaccines, about how this virus spreads, and there's a lot of fear and of the unknown, and because of that, they can be very easily manipulated and be told that, you know, this RNA is going to affect your genetic material, sort of thing. So I think number one is that the clear communication, also having people who stand up for the facts. I think one of the trends that we've been seeing is that people just think that, okay, it's that's your point of view on the fact, but you know, my point of view on the fact being wrong is also acceptable because it's an opposite view. So this kind of thing is making it very complicated, I think, for the experts to actually exert what is actually a generally accepted view. I'm not saying that science knows everything, because the nature of science is that as we discover new things, views change. But the problem is that people see this lack of certainty as a way of not having any legitimacy. So I'll give you an example. COVID is a very new virus. And throughout the past 12 months, people have been learning new things about it. At first, they thought it was spread to touch, and now we now know that it's spread through aerosols, and therefore before, WHO perhaps was not recommending universal masking, and a few months later they changed and they said yes on universal masking. But people see that change of policy as indicative of a conspiracy rather than an evolving body of knowledge, and I think that that just makes it very complicated, because the problems that we're dealing with are complex problems. If they were simple, you know, they would have been solved.
Understood.
That understanding and appreciation of complexity, I think, has sort of like diminished, I think.
Where is the cajoling and persuasion to make them want to have that mindset change, to reset and to be in the pandemic era where the mask is more often than not compulsory by our own accord, for example? So do you think that this has to do with allowing for more open and high-quality discourse to really flourish?
I'm afraid not. I think Nadia got it right in describing the problem. We have a situation now where the new media has allowed a proliferation of ostensibly competing ideas, and where you can, because there is little confidence in the usual sources of information, You actually allow a lot of doubt to come in and allow alternative views of reality to come in. And a lot of this is quite frankly nonsense. And then at the other end, you have the reification of science. And this is my main objection to the fourth industrial revolution, because the implication is that there's something which has happened in the last few years which is so significantly different, whereas if you take, for example, artificial intelligence, it has been going on for 4 decades, at least. Digitalization has been going on for more than 5 decades. I remember before I even went to university, the development of some of the integrated circuits and so on and so forth. So you have all this happening over time, and it's been cumulative, and there's been accelerations, undoubtedly. You know, nanotechnology is more recent, perhaps, and so on and so forth. But we need to get away from allowing, you know, people to mislead others, politicians, you know, using buzzwords. And this is my main objection to the fourth industrial revolution. I'm not against the technical changes and innovations which it implies. But if we reify it and imply that, you know, there's something magical which has happened in the last decade, that is a problem. That is the real problem, you know. And digitization, I mean, Surinam can tell you that it began well before she was born, you know. But you know, if we reify it, we create new alternative myths. So you have competing myths, and this is a problem, a huge problem, which Nadia, I think, has put her finger on.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to force. There's no democracy because Nadia said the word just now. For efficiency, one thing to you that can kickstart in any geography or any nation or globally or whatever it is, one thing that needs to happen for us to be able to reset and use technology more often than not. Ian, I'm going to give you the first right.
Well, this is where I have an advantage going first, because I can crowdsource what everyone else has said. So actually, Serena, I think, made the point several times now around changing mindsets. And to me, that's the one thing that I 100% agree, because I think we see that if we can change our mindset, and if we can make the idea of lifelong learning journeys, whether that's through the adoption of technology or how we approach ideas around collaboration, that's going to be critical at every level of organizations, whether you're talking about senior political or business leaders, all the way down to the person on our shop floors. And by enabling that change of mindset to, it's not that I have this period of phase where that's my training phase, but rather that this is something that exists throughout my entire career, I think we're going to be able to unlock a lot of the potential and I think address some of these challenges. And to the professor's point, I agree. I don't think that any of these concepts should be rarefied. I think that this is the idea here, of even when we talk about the fourth industrial revolution, is that this is something that's happening. And it's something that everybody has the ability to engage with if we change our mindset to, this is something that we can adapt to over time, and we need to look at integrating into our everyday lives.
Doc Jomo, one thing that we must do now that can change and give hope.
Kamarul, you know very well I cannot answer that question.
Of course you can, just one.
Okay, there's no one size magical solution.
Okay, fine, then give two.
Situations. But in Malaysia, I think getting to terms with this crisis which people are increasingly feeling that it is exaggerated and manufactured. And this is very dangerous, because it is being seen as the pretext for having emergency rules, suspension of parliament, reduction of accountability, and so on and so forth. We have to reduce that kind of pervasive cynicism in society, precisely to increase the trust, which everybody around this discussion agrees is so essential. So what we really need is a much more comprehensive approach. Almost for 9 months, 10 months, I've been calling for what I call an all of government approach and a whole of society approach. You cannot do this as a series of instructions from high on without involving all of society, without involving the expertise which exists. You know, once upon a time, a long, long time ago, perhaps, you know, the expertise might only reside in government. But those days are long gone, you know. What we need to do is to be able to learn. We need to be able to learn very, very quickly from our own mistakes, from our own experience, and to be able to acknowledge them. Nadia gave a very good example about how the WHO has updated its own guidance. And then likewise, we need to learn from the science, because especially with COVID-19, the science is changing almost by the day. You know, we are learning new things almost every day about this virus and the epidemic it is causing. And the other thing which we need to do is to learn from other experiences. And ironically, my experience with the World Economic Forum was they discovered me in response to the East Asian crisis, okay, a long time ago for many of you. But after that, I was quite dispensable. But what we find now is that the East Asian governments have done relatively much better. You know, the only place where growth is happening in the world during the year 2020 has basically been in East Asia, in China, in Korea, in Vietnam, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we have, once again, look east policy is very relevant for this
don't gender. Worry.
Unfortunately, it's not happening.
Don't worry, Doc. WEF is coming to East Asia in May. One Nadia first. You're not Dr. Jomo's generation. You're the Twitter generation, 240 characters only. Okay, go ahead. One thing.
I think the one thing that we all need to do is really be comfortable with discomfort. Because I think a lot of the issues that we're facing right now is that people are looking for silver bullets in absolutism, in something that fits in with their worldview. And when it doesn't, it's scary, and it stops progress. I mean, the whole adoption of work from home, the technology had existed way before. I mean, you know, 10 years or maybe when I was still in high school. But it's about the fear of corporate leaders of what would happen if I let my staff stay at home and I can't see them face to face, would they still be productive? And it wasn't a question about whether the technology was available. It was something about confronting their own perceptions and fears. And this is the only thing I think that's going to stop progress.
Okay. Serena?
So for me, I think that we talked about a lot of things today, the complexities of the problems that we have, the change in mindset that's required. But to me, ultimately, it comes down to leadership, but not just leadership, it's execution. Now is really the time to drive change. It's all about rolling up your sleeves. At least on MDEC side, we're really committed. We're intensifying our efforts. Never before have we worked so hard to deliver more with less in half the time. That's all of these things. And it's really all about making sure that things work for society. There are lots of people out there that don't have food on the table, that don't have connectivity. And so we can't just sit around and just talk. We just need to execute and build a digital economy or a better world, whatever you want to call it, that works for us all. So it comes down to me, it's execution.
And I would like to end, it's almost 14 years that I'm with Awani, but one thing that I want to take out from those experiences in Awani is that Estonia. When I interviewed the founding father of Digital Economy of Estonia and the first female technopreneur of Estonia that I could catch and interview, they give me a story of how Estonia was so poor coming out of colonization. And this was in 1990s where Nadia has already understand about, you know, love and things like that, not too far ago. They had their independence in early 1990s. The first few years, when the bread truck runs across the house, the kids will be running after it because they were so poor that if they can just smell the bread, and you know, if you have been to Europe, bread is very important, that's enough. And yet, the first 3 to 5 years, they made the sacrifice not to patch up the ceiling of the school where water was dripping on the heads of the teachers and the students, but to invest in ICT infrastructure so that they can become an ICT-based economy. So that's all I have for today. Thank you so much for being with us on this special affiliate session of the World Economic Forum, Davos Agenda Week. We can beat this pandemic and we can do the Great Reset. Thank you and goodbye.